The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to The Dan Proft Show. Thank you for joining us for another installment. DanProftShow.com is a way to follow us on social media, at Dan Proft Show, Facebook and Twitter, also at Dan Proft, Instagram too, Proft underscore Dan, I think is my Instagram account. And we start on this program with a wrap-up of all of the pronouncements on coronavirus over the weekend from public health officials, some associated with the Trump administration, some not, as well as discussion. We'll have a more detailed discussion at the bottom of this hour with Jonathan Honig, the capitalist pig, about the hammering that continues in the market as fears continue to spread against the backdrop of announcements like Italy cordoning off a quarter of its population and shutting down one of the real areas that provide the vitality of the Italian economy, for example, as well as Dr. Scott Gottlieb, Trump's former FDA director, suggesting that something similar may have to happen to local economies in this country, depending on the nature of the outbreak more severe, the infectation rate more severe in some regions of the country as compared to others in the U.S. So let's just start with some of what we understand to be true from the healthcare professionals who are trying to synthesize data in real time, as well as provide appropriate advice and counsel. Assistant Secretary for Health at HHS, Health and Human Services. He is an admiral and medical doctor, Brett Chua. And here's what he had to say over the weekend about the lethality rate of coronavirus at as we know it at this point.
We are still very early in understanding, and all the evidence isn't there, so I want to caveat that. But to set some foundation, the typical mortality rate for seasonal flu is about 0.1% or 0.15%. The best estimates now of the overall mortality rate for COVID-19 is somewhere between 0.1% and 1%, okay? That's lower than you heard probably in many reports. Why is this? Number one is because many people don't get sick and don't get tested. So probably for, and this is reflects the overseas experience, so probably for every case, there are at least two or three cases that are not in the denominator. So I just want to sort of scale that it's certainly could be higher than normal flu. It probably is, but it's not likely in the range of 2 to 3%. So our best modeling, again, you have a denominator problem, and I want you to understand that only the people who are really sick or have symptoms come in and get tested. So based on the models we have right now, we estimate the mortality as 0.1 to 1%. It is likely not in the range of 2 to 3%.
And you also have people acting responsibly. It's nice to see some leadership from elected officials. For example, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, Representative Paul Gosar from Arizona, both self-quarantine after a report you probably saw over the weekend that there was someone at the CPAC conference the week before last, Conservative Political Action Conference. President spoke there. Someone there tested positive for coronavirus, and both Cruz as well as Gosar apparently came into contact with that person, and so they are self-quarantining for the next 2 weeks. Even Kiel, staying calm and carrying on, but quarantining so as not to spread the virus, which is responsible. And those were the sentiments echoed by Surgeon General Jerome Adams, who was on with Jake Tapper over the weekend, trying to provide some perspective on the efforts that are being made, both on the containment side, but as the virus spreads, mitigation side as well.
Now we're shifting into a mitigation phase, which means that we're helping communities understand you're going to see more cases. Unfortunately, you're going to see more deaths. But that doesn't mean that we should panic. It means that we should take the things that we know work for individuals to protect themselves and make sure everyone is doing those things, like washing your hands frequently, like covering your cough, like staying home if you're sick and not being around people who are sick. But it also means communities need to be thinking about things like, should we be canceling large gatherings? What are our telework policies? Should we be closing schools? And that's going to be different in Seattle than what it's going to be in Jackson, Mississippi. But communities need to have that conversation and prepare for more cases so that we can prevent more deaths.
I know there's inclination to say, well, federal response, uniformity of rules, established thresholds for when schools should be closed or large gatherings should be suspended or postponed. Again, as many have said, this is happening differently in different places. Just as we see around the world, Taiwan and Singapore have responded to and contained, mitigated the spread of coronavirus much better than, say, China has, or South Korea, or Italy. So it could very well be the case that there are different cities or population centers in this country that will handle it better than others. Shouldn't it be another example of the subsidiarity which undergirds our federalist system, the idea of power closest to the people making these decisions rather than a one-size-fits-all approach from D.C.? I'm certainly inclined to the former. Again, Surgeon General Dr. Adams providing some perspective on the 22 individuals, Americans, who have died from coronavirus, more than 500 cases, obviously more than 100,000 worldwide, but here's some perspective.
Some parts of the country are having much more severe flu seasons. Some are having a very mild flu seasons. The same thing for coronavirus. So you want to first try to keep it out of your community. Once you know it's in your community, you want to take the steps to prevent spread within the community and to keep those most at risk safe. And a very important point here, we now know more about who is at risk. Average age of death for people from coronavirus is 80. Average age of people who need medical attention is age 60. We want people who are older, people who have medical conditions, to take steps to protect themselves, including avoiding crowded spaces, including thinking very carefully about whether or not now's the time to get on that cruise ship and whether now's the time to take that long-haul flight.
And, of course, on Sunday, the State Department issued a travel advisory against Americans traveling on cruise ships at this point. But that was just yesterday that that advisory was issued. Now, there's talk about March Madness right around the corner, playing those March Madness games without fans. There's talk about playing NBA games without fans. One LeBron James, he weighed in on the idea of playing for the Lakers without Lakers fans, or the home team's fans, if the Lakers are playing away, in the stands. No fans, no LeBron.
Do you play games without the fans?
No,
it's impossible. I ain't playing. I ain't got the fans in the crowd. That's what I play for. I play for my teammates, play for the fans. That's what it's all about. So.
All right, there you have it. No fans, no LeBron. You don't have no fans, you don't get no LeBron. Okay. All right. I wanted to also just pick up a review by Jun Yun, who is a medical doctor. He's also a president of Palo Alto Investors. He talks about the coronavirus data and how it's misleading, and how misleading, not in the sense of arguing about whether or not it's accurate, misleading in the sense of it's a secondary issue. Second order matter. And so this is sort of a more of a metaphysical discussion that he efforts, as opposed to just arguing about, how long you should wash your hands, or whether or not you should go to that ball game, or whether or not you should take that flight. He writes, Dr. Yun, the vortex of fear. We should really get to the bottom of this while we are caught in the vortex of fear, lest we want to be visited by unwanted sequels every 2 to 5 years. And of course, we have been over the last 20, right? H1N1, SARS, MERS, Zika, Ebola. At the center of this powerful vortex is the principal agent problem that infected human civilization at its roots at the end of the kin tribe age of human social evolution. Whereas humans were once fed, informed, and governed by those who had our best interests at heart, in post-diaspora melting pots like America, we are fed, informed, and governed by those who have their own best interest at heart. It used to be, when societal and familial bonds were tight, ruled by those with our best interest at heart, now governed by those with their best interest at heart. Big difference. And it speaks to the self-dealing that goes on among those in charge of powerful institutions, those organizing civic institutions in a free society. And it, in part, is a description of what prompted the revolt that elected Trump in 2016, I would argue. What Dr. Yoon argues is, what I hope happens to the story from here, the coronavirus story, is that we begin addressing the first-order cause of human social dysfunctions rather than whack-a-moling its second-order symptoms, like the anxiety gripping a populace dealing with a heretofore unknown virus. And then listen to this line. This is a line that requires a little bit of reflection, but it's succinctly put. Simply put, our family values did not scale as we globalized, but virality has. Our family values did not scale as we globalized, but virality has. Uh-huh. Producing the unintended externality of the principal agent problem in the post-kin tribe era of human evolution, where we're lorded over by people putting their best interests ahead of their constituents' best interests. Fundamental principal agent problem. First order problem. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. So it possibly will be Bernie's last stand in Michigan tomorrow night. If he is unable to win Michigan, then it's a probably curtains for the Bolshevik. That just doesn't seem like he's able to resuscitate his campaign, but he's trying to stage one more comeback in Michigan. And he enlisted the big guns, or at least what's left of the big guns for the socialists, Jesse Jackson in Grand Rapids over the weekend.
I stand with Bernie Sanders today because he stood with me. I stand with him because he stands with you.
You can thank him, but probably not going to be enough, although it is nice to see that socialists have each other's back. Referencing was Jackson Sr., Bernie endorsing him back in 1988 during his ill-fated run for president of the United States. Meanwhile, Joe Biden is doing his best to try to help Bernie stay in the race by continuing to call into question his mental acuity. For example, it was Joe O. Biden running to reelect President Trump in St. Louis over the weekend.
Turn this primary from a campaign that's about negative attacks into one about what we're for, because we cannot get reelect. We cannot win this reelection. Excuse me. We can only reelect Donald Trump.
Well said.
You want to nominate a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat, a proud Democrat, an Obama Democrat.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Nate Hochman. He's a former editorial intern at National Review, alumnus of the American Enterprise Institute's Summer Honors Academy, and now contributor to the American Conservative and Washington Examiner. Nate, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, do I have the read right that if Bernie doesn't put a marker down in Michigan, then it's all but over for him? And let me add one more thing. Being an Illinois resident, there's a poll out in Illinois that has Biden up 30 in the land of Lincoln, which is the primary March 17th. So it doesn't get better for Bernie than Michigan.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You know, I am loath to make any sort of absolutist political predictions. I was, you know, along with the rest of the pundit class, I was predicting that Bernie Sanders was inevitable just mere weeks ago. So who knows? But it's certainly looking like his candidacy is dead, and the coalition that he sort of said he was going to build showed up, you know, the multiracial, diverse, working-class coalition, but they showed up in droves for Joe Biden. They didn't vote for him. You know, the American electorate writ large is still much more conservative than Bernie Sanders would like, and they're just deeply uncomfortable with his radical brand of politics.
Tom Steyer had an op-ed in the New York Times over the weekend, what he learned while running for president. And the upshot is he didn't learn very much. He just used this opportunity as a way to offer the same pandering bull jive that he offered in spending $250 million to get zero delegates. But I'm not so sure a postmortem on Steyer is merited, but certainly on Warren and Bloomberg it is. And you wrote one on Warren. She lost because, you know, people just aren't ready for a female president, even in the Democrat primary. Nancy Pelosi seemed to echo that, complaining about misogyny among her own party's primary electorate.
That's right. Not only misogyny amongst her own party's primary electorate, but misogyny amongst the primary electorate that nominated Hillary Clinton to the presidency a mere, you know, 3.5 years
right,
ago.
Right.
So it's, you know, and also misogyny amongst the Massachusetts electorate, which elected Elizabeth Warren to be senator, and she lost the state of Massachusetts and lost the female vote in Massachusetts. So it's not entirely surprising that this is sort of what Elizabeth Warren is resorting to explain her own significant personal shortcomings as a candidate. But it's certainly not true, despite the fact that she and her surrogates in the media and in the progressive Twitter sphere say that it's true.
Yeah, I mean, is it possible? I know this is a lark. This just go with me on this. You know, this is crazy talk. But is it possible that she, much like Kamala Harris, just turned out not to be particularly likable, particularly good candidates, particularly attractive politically?
Dan, if you were really woke enough, I think you'd understand that likability is actually a sexist dog whistle.
Right, yes.
Concerns about electability are also a sexist dog whistle. Actually, criticism of female candidates at all is a sexist dog whistle, according to the sort of progressive establishment. You know, that strikes me as in and of itself enormously sexist. It robs women of their capacity to be rational, mm-hmm. individual agents who can take responsibility for themselves. It's an enormous double standard that sort of the feminist left has created. But Elizabeth Warren has benefited from it immensely. You know, she has an enormous fan base in the sort of progressive media, the New York Times editorial board. But unfortunately, what she found out was that the American electorate writ large and even the Democratic base isn't the New York Times editorial board. And you can pontificate about intersectionality until you're blue in the face. And, you know, folks in the media will love it and folks on Twitter will love it. But the, you know, blue collar worker in Michigan or the, you know, African-American electorate in South Carolina isn't going to go for it. And they didn't. And that's something that Elizabeth Warren had to come face to face with. In the past few weeks.
Now, I hear what you're saying about electability being a patriarchal construct, but then you have to explain Kamala Harris to me over the weekend endorsing Joe Biden. Here's Kamala Harris.
I just wanted you guys to know I have decided that I am with great enthusiasm going to endorse Joe Biden for president of the United States. I believe in Joe. I really believe in him, and I have known him for a long time. One of the things that we need right now is we need a leader who really does care about the people and who can therefore unify the people. And I believe Joe can do that. I am supporting Joe because I believe that he is a man who has lived his life with great dignity. He is a public servant who has always worked for the best of who we are as a nation. And we need that right now. There is so much at stake in this election, guys. So join me in supporting Joe, and let's get this done.
Now, how could Kamala Harris, you know, fold into, you know, that sort of dog whistling there, Nate?
Well, first of all, I have to say that was probably the least enthusiastic recitation of "with great enthusiasm" that I've ever heard. But, you know, Joe Biden isn't exactly the passion candidate. But, yeah, you know, look, if you're a hammer, everything is a nail. And for, you know, folks on the left, on the left wing of the Democratic Party, sexism and racism and a litany of other bigotries explain everything. It's sort of any failure of progressive candidates like Elizabeth Warren, who were deeply unlikable, were to the left of even the Democratic electorate on a host of social issues like abortion, and also had zero relatability for folks in the middle of the country. Those aren't explanations for folks like Elizabeth Warren. Sexism and racism are sort of the one-size-fits-all explanations, and you're seeing that deployed by her and her surrogates now. And you saw her talk about sexism throughout her candidacy. But the fact of the matter is that it wasn't sexism, and Elizabeth Warren was just not a very likable candidate.
He is Nate Hochman. He is a contributor to the American Conservative and Washington Examiner. Nate, thanks so much for joining us at the Dan Prof Show. Appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
Take care.
But now all the poodles run to my house for the funky Comadina. You know what I'm saying?
I got every dog in my neighborhood breaking down my door. I got Spuds and Kenzie, Alex from Strohs. They won't leave my dog alone with that Medina fam. I went out to this girl. She said, hi, my name is Sheena. I thought she'd be good to go with a little funky cold Medina. She said, I'd like it.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Well, quite a day on the market with trading being halted at about 9:35 Central Time this morning. That's an unusual occurrence, and here's why it occurred. The new circuit breakers in the market, New York Stock Exchange, if the S&P 500 dropped 7%, trading pauses for 15 minutes, which is what happened this morning. If it declines 13%, trading will again pause for 15 minutes if the drop occurs on or before 3:25 Eastern time. There will be no halt if a drop happens after that. And then the third and final circuit breaker, if the S&P 500 falls 20%, trading would halt for the remainder of the day. These are highly unusual occurrences under the new circuit breakers. I don't think there's been a halt in trading since the flash crash of 2010, and maybe going back to 1997 before that. But for more history on this and the implications of it, we're pleased to be joined by our friend, the Capitalist Pig. He is Jonathan Honig. He is also the author of A New Textbook of Americanism, The Politics of Ayn Rand. Jonathan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Dan, as you said, I mean, really historic. Spending a lot of today just kind of rubbing my eyes and looking at my screen at some price movements all over the map, not just in stocks, but in the price of credit, in bonds, in the price of oil, and other commodities making some moves. That, as you said, I mean, you have to go back to the global financial crisis in 2008, maybe before then, as you said, the flash crash, or even 2000 to see some of the moves that we've seen today in markets.
Yeah, and so, I mean, just were you surprised that the crisis, panic, anxiety took this form on this day, or sort of is this the natural progression of running through the sort of panic we started seeing in the market in the last week?
Well, you know, we have seen, as you said, Dan, you know, we've seen fears start to build in the markets for, boy, the better part of a month now. And you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one who's used this metaphor, but not unlike a virus, the concern is growing about just the size of the impact that, you know, this is going to have on the global economy and specifically the American economy. You know, we're used these last couple of weeks, for example, to seeing cruise stocks and airlines companies doing very poorly. But, you know, today, for example, you saw the banks get absolutely walloped. So there's more of fear of just, you know, the spread of a virus here. What you're seeing is a real fear of a global slowdown. Call it recession if you want. We won't really know till after the fact. But you know, that's what you really saw today, is tremendous fear that the economy, the global economy, is moving even a lot slower than we thought.
The FANG stocks and other blue chip stocks, I mean, these are solid companies with robust balance sheets that really didn't change the fundamental nature of Apple or Amazon didn't change from January to March. And so are you sanguine about a recovery in the spring if we start to see the incidence of infections decline and things slowly returning to normal?
Well, it would be great to see. And, you know, what you asked a bit about history, Dan. You know, one of the good signs, ironically, is the panic that we've seen. You know, we've seen there's innumerable types of measures, what they call the VIX index, which is an index of fear, or indices that track the numbers of overbought and oversold stocks. So based on history, there's a lot of reason to believe that, as you said, the market is due for a bounce, and probably a pretty substantial one. Now, as to the viability of companies like, you know, Apple, as you said, tremendous companies, but also you have to have a little context here. I mean, the market, and specifically some of these companies like Apple, have basically been on fire for the better part of a decade. So what we could see here is just basically investors taking profits, pulling bids out of the market because of the fact that, despite the fact that Apple's a great company, we've had a huge run, the global economy is slowing, and they're saying now is the time to essentially take the money and run, given the slower growth that they anticipate for the market.
We're talking to the capitalist pig, Jonathan Honig. Jonathan, when we come back, I want to ask you if you're interested in a flight to quality. Where do you land in the, at this moment? We'll be back with more capitalist pig right after this.
Money, it's a gas.
Now you listen to me. I want trading to be opened right now. Get those brokers back in here. Turn those machines back on. Turn those machines back on.
Turning to the stock market, Animotion is up an eighth.
Yes!
After plunging 75 points this morning.
Oh, I hope plunging means up.
Money! Get back. I'm off my jack. Keep your hands off of my stack. Money!
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Jonathan Honig. He is the capitalist pig. He is also the author of a new textbook of Americanism, The Politics of Ayn Rand, and we're talking about the wild and willy times on Wall Street these days. And Jonathan, when we left, I asked you if somebody is shaken enough by what's happened in the market today, talking about the halt in trading this morning, and looking to fly to quality, where would they land?
Well, first and foremost, then, you cannot be led by your emotions in life and certainly not in the stock market. So pull yourself away from the headlines, however bleak and scary they might be, and you know, you have to kind of go back to your own personal context and yourself as an investor. I mean, truly, we've talked about this in the last couple of weeks. You know, if you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, even 50s, if you're years away from retirement, even these terrible headlines and very tenuous, frightening markets shouldn't change your long-term plan. And that's the irony, Dan, is everyone says they're in it for the long haul, but then the market goes down 10%. And they say, get me the hell out of here.
I'm only in for the long haul when it's up 30%. Then I'm in for the long haul.
Exactly. You know, the main thing to keep in mind, and, you know, we've talked about this over the years, is you always want to have a sound financial footing on which you stand. You want to have your credit card bills paid down, and you want to have 6 months worth of living expenses. Why? Exactly for reasons like today, so that when the market drops, you're not that much more concerned and paralyzed because of the fear of the money that you simply don't have. That's what's so unfortunate in today's economy is a lot of people, you know, in 2007, they were living beyond their means when it comes to their houses. This time it's much more on the credit card. So if you can just put yourself in that, now you ask, I'll get to your question, you know, what do you do for safety? Well, J.P. Morgan, I think, you know, 100 years ago said it best. People asked him, market's crazy, what should I do? His point was to sell down to the sleeping point, you know, meaning that if you're so heavily indebted and you're so heavily invested, that a 5, 7, you know, even 15% drop in the market, which is normal, you know, Dana, we'd like to think that, you know, markets just go up year after year, and since the global financial crisis, they kind of seem like that. But bear markets and corrections are normal over the long term. We're certainly due for one. So if a 15% drop in the value of your holdings or a 20% drop is too much for you to bear, then maybe it is an opportune moment to take some of that off the table and reallocate. But just resist the urge to do it all based on emotions. Always go back to your own context, your own situation, your own long-term goals.
And yeah, and so, you know, so let's say you're a little bit closer to retirement and you want to go to safety because you want to salvage the gains you have realized over the last couple of years. And so, I mean, are you going into T-bills? Are you going into real property in this interest rate environment trending to zero? Where do you go?
Well, it's one of the funny parts here, Dan, is that older Americans, those close to retirement, maybe it's funny, it's a little bit of a kind of a black comedy situation, is that if you own good old-fashioned boring government bonds, you've made a tremendous amount of money this year. Bond funds, which are in a lot of people's, as you said, 401ks, retirement funds, you know, bond funds are up 10, 15, some cases 20% this year because people have been, as you said, running for safety. So I think, you know, in many ways, those are overvalued as well. There's an old saying that says, when elephants are dancing, mice get trampled. So my thought is, you don't have to make, you know, and elephants are certainly dancing today and this whole week on Wall Street. So, you know, if you take some money off the table, don't feel that urge to necessarily have to plow, you know, got to plow into something next. It's not a terrible thing to let the dust settle a little bit, given the tremendous types of moves we've had.
I'm going to try and get one more Wall Street aphorism from you before we go. I love it. Let me ask you this about you know, part of the discussion now, the geopolitical discussion in response to coronavirus as well as the economic impacts of coronavirus is, well, you know, this is why we shouldn't rely on global supply chains. This is why we should be encouraging U.S. companies to divest from China in particular. Maybe other countries perhaps as well, and onshore their supply chains so as to insulate themselves from just this sort of occurrence. What do you say to the arguments for autarky?
I kind of understand the idea behind it. The idea of diversifying your supply chain is something that most, you know, Fortune 500s do very well, do very efficiently. You know, something like this, Dan, they call it a black swan because it's exactly that. It's something you really can't plan for and anticipate. And in fact, it's not just China. I mean, Apple, for example, closed their entire Cupertino campus, that, you know, massive spaceship operation. Thousands and thousands of employees in companies that you think are not even, you know, related to travel or anything to do with China are being affected. So this truly is a type of black swan event that I think even diversifying your supply chain as a big company wouldn't ultimately be able to save you. This is something that can't be modeled, can't be planned for, just has to be endured. And look, we are still the most individualistic and capitalist country in the history of the world, and I think we're going to do a lot better coming out of this than basically anywhere else.
How do you assess, you know, everybody's focused on the federal, state, local governmental response to this. How do you assess the marketplace's response? And I don't mean the Wall Street. I mean corporate and the entrepreneurial set, their response to this, whether it's big pharma coming together to collaborate to try and develop antiviral drugs and a vaccine, or it's the big tech companies trying to respond to protect their supply chains.
I think it's admirable. And, you know, the big companies want to not only protect their supply chains, but, you know, damn, they want to protect their employees. They want to keep them healthy. They want to keep them safe. So big companies from the get-go were very adamant about telling people to stay home, telecommute, work from home, cutting off supply chains. They don't want to put their employees at risk. So, you know, they've been very adamant. I know the government has as well. But everyone is kind of stumbling through what really is a crisis. And that's exactly why you see the tumult in the market. If you think the market's going to be closed, if you think companies' operations are going to be shut down, it's that uncertainty that prompts people to say, sell now and ask questions later. But if you truly have that long-term focus, you know that companies ranging from Apple to ConocoPhillips and all the rest are not going out of business. As you said, they all are going to come back. And that's why you really have to now more than ever try to keep that long-term perspective.
He is the capitalist pig, a voice of reason and restraint and reflection. That's always welcome. He's also the author of a new textbook of Americanism, The Politics of Ayn Rand. Jonathan Honig, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Anytime, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Money, 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 money.
The more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Well, here's a fun prospect to think about. How about as an undercard to Trump-Biden debates, if that's what the matchup ends up being, Trump Jr. versus Hunter Biden? Yeah, the D.C. press corps is already in overdrive trying to warn Trump and Trump surrogates from going after touching a hair on the dainty head of Hunter Biden. He's off limits. And Tim O'Brien, flack for Michael Bloomberg, was on with the insufferable Joy Reid over the weekend, threatening that the Trump world will have hell to pay if they go after Biden. Hunter, that is.
You know, the Trump family are epic grifters, and this goes back generations. Fred Trump made his money by intersecting with both the federal government and state government in New York. Donald came up through New York, intersecting with local government and in Atlantic City. They've gone now. They are now in the White House, and all of them are dipping their faces into the till. And if the Republicans really want to make an issue out of Hunter Biden, which is very low-hanging fruit that I don't think most Democratic voters care about anyway, there is going to be a scorched earth response aimed at all of the Trump children that is unlike anything they've experienced thus far in the media.
Well, could it be from your former candidate? Because Michael Bloomberg has got a lot of money to spend, and there's a lot of ads you could make on something like that.
I think it's an important moment for the American people to be woke about how rampant the financial conflicts of interest are among Trump's children.
To be woke, right? Oh, I understand, Tim O'Brien. In other words, to be woke means to be brainwashed. That's what you're going for. That's what woke is a synonym for, isn't it not? Yeah. Well, in terms of scorched earth and exposing the Trump family the way that Peter Schweizer exposed the Biden family, Don Trump Jr., in an interview with Axios, said, bring it on.
I was an international business person before my father got into politics. That's what we did. I'm not going to say I haven't benefited from my father's last name, just like Hunter Biden did. I'd be foolish to say that. But I haven't benefited from my father's taxpayer-funded office. Okay? Hunter Biden, his father becomes VP. All of a sudden, he goes over to the Ukraine, and he's making $83,000 a month. So, you know, the media likes to do this sort of false equivalence. You're doing this, you're doing that. We stopped doing any new international business deals when my father won the presidency. So, you know what would be great? I'll let you host it. You moderate a debate between Hunter Biden and myself.
Come on. Yeah, yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Yeah.
We can go.
I love it. Full
transparency.
I love it. Full transparency. Trump Jr. is willing to stand and deliver. It took months and months and months for Hunter Biden to do a relatively softball interview with ABC News. I love it. I love it. I'm serious. Undercard. Trump Jr. versus Hunter Biden. And then the main event, Trump versus Biden. It could very well be a very fun election cycle, particularly if we can get past coronavirus. This is the Dan Prof Show.
From the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Prof Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Prof, and this is the Dan Prof Show.
They got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Yeah, the campus beat, and takes us to Hyde Park, University of Chicago. The Chicago Statement, that's how it's referred. The statement of opposition to trigger warnings and safe spaces, because universities are and should be marketplaces of ideas. Free exchange, not top-down or peer-to-peer censorship. This, back in 2016, John Ellison, the dean of students at U of C, to the class of 2020, wrote, "Our commitment to academic freedom means we do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial. We do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own." Robert Zimmer, the president, U of C, in a Wall Street Journal op-ed following that missive from his dean of students, "Universities cannot be viewed as a sanctuary for comfort, but rather as a crucible for confronting ideas and thereby learning to make informed judgments in complex environments. Having one's assumptions challenged and experiencing the discomfort that sometimes accompanies the this process are intrinsic parts of an excellent education. Only then will students develop the skills necessary to build their own futures and contribute to society. Well, these are champions of free expression and robust substantive debate on campus, and they're not going to tolerate the sort of thuggery that you see on campuses not named University of Chicago, right? No, wrong. It's a fun statement of principle. It's a fun marketing tool. But if you talk to U of C students, it's a statement that is not reflective of the campus culture. And so while you have some people paying lip service to ideas like those expressed by U of C's Robert Zimmer and John Ellison, in practice, it just is the case in very few institutions of higher education, alleged higher education. And so U of C gives us Evita Duffy. Evita Duffy is a second-year student at University of Chicago, and she's also the daughter of Representative Sean Duffy and Rachel Campos Duffy. There was a University of Chicago Institute of Politics digital initiative called I Vote Because blank dot, 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 where students pose with a small whiteboard stating their personal reasons for voting. Some examples, this is her op-ed, some examples included Medicare for All, universal health care shouldn't be considered a radical idea, children shouldn't be kept in cages, I vote because, ellipsis, those were some of the answers. She's a conservative Hispanic woman, as she points out. She wrote, I vote because the coronavirus won't destroy America, but socialism will. Is that particularly offensive to anybody? Well, it was to all of those Bernie bros and sisses on campus. She says, recounts, does Evita Duffy, fellow students attack my character, my intellect, my family, my appearance, even threaten me with physical violence using foul and offensive language. I was called a racist and a xenophobe. I don't even know how that you can apply that criticism to that statement, but okay. Some compared me to animals. Others declared that they would personally stop me from voting. And many defended the personal attack, saying, I deserve to be bullied. I don't belong at University of Chicago on account of my beliefs. I was told by many that I was the most hated person on campus. It was frightening. It was also hurtful, since some of the attacks came from people I considered friends. As writing this opinion, which you wrote last week, the administration and the Institute of Politics, that's that alternatively known by me as David Axelrod's Institute for Political Skullduggery, which is what it actually is, have not come to my defense, she writes. The administration, IOP, have not come to my defense, nor have they condemned the intolerance and violence students have directed toward me. Just another day on a college campus. For more on this topic, generally speaking, we're pleased to be joined by Mary Graybar, Executive Director of Dissident Prof, resident fellow at the Alexander Hamilton Institute, and author of Debunking Howard Zinn, Exposing the Fake History That Turned a Generation Against America. Mary, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So University of Chicago, here we go again, one of our elite institutions. These are the best and brightest that matriculate there. And this is the culture on campus, as so described by Evita Duffy.
Yeah, and it's a shame, particularly because the University of Chicago has had a reputation as being very rigorous and dedicated to scholarly inquiry for the longest time. It had that reputation. I know when I was in graduate school, and that's one of our highest institutions that has fallen. The ideology has spread like a poison.
Howard Zinn, so for people not familiar, most notably People's History of the United States, which made its way into a lot of K-12 school systems and exists to this day. How influential has his book and the teachers who treat it as gospel in informing students' understanding of America? How much of what we see on college campuses today is a direct result of the teaching of American history from that perspective for the last few generations?
Well, yes, the book's been in print since 1980. It's sold probably over 3 million copies now. There is the Zinn Education Project, which is a nonprofit that was started by one of Zinn's students from Boston University, who became quite wealthy in the evil capitalist system. Hmm. That has had over 100,000 teachers signing up to get free downloadable materials. Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, is being used in high school classrooms, especially for advanced placement U.S. history. It is in the form of a young people's history of the United States, which is geared towards middle school students. And the downloadable materials from the Zinn Education Project are tailored to specific grades as young as first grade and kindergarten. There are spin-off books, A People's History of American Empire, People's History of Art History of the Civil War, and on and on. There are movies, documentaries that are available for sale that are shown in classrooms. I've come across books.
Yeah,
and excerpts.
Right, but now take one of those modules and give us a flavor of what you get from Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn tackling the Civil War, tackling the Civil Rights Movement, tackling World War II.
Well, for the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Panthers are civil rights leaders. World War II. The U.S. was as fascist, if not more so, than the Nazis. For Christopher Columbus, there is a role play activity where Christopher Columbus is put on trial. So a lot of these activities are role play. So students don't even have to read anything. They are directed by their teachers to take certain roles, and Christopher Columbus comes under indictment. And, of course, they read a short passage from Zinn's A People's History of the United States, the famous opening chapter, which is full of critical omissions and plagiarisms, as I detail in my book. And it's very deceptive the way he presents Christopher Columbus. One way that I point out is from page one, where he uses ellipses to leave out critical information that gives the opposite impression of what Christopher Columbus actually intended. So students might get this kind of a sentence, which also was used in an episode of The Sopranos. So they would make fine servants, the dot, 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 the ellipses that indicate that, you know, some information was left out but not critical. And then he goes on, with 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. Well, what's left out is, as I point out in my book, I know that they are a people who can be made free and converted to our holy faith more by love than by force. So those are Christopher Columbus's words. He wants to convert the natives to Christianity, and he wants to do it with love more than by force. The way Howard Zinn presents it is that, that Christopher Columbus simply wants to enslave them all and subjugate them.
She is Mary Graybar. She's the executive director of Dissident Prof. She's also a resident fellow at the Alexander Hamilton Institute. And the book, Debunking Howard Zinn, Exposing the Fake History That Turned a Generation Against America. Mary, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And University of Illinois offering a buyback of racist merchandise, quote unquote racist merchandise, featuring the school's former mascot, Chief Illiniwek. The students who wanted to remove the chief also want to remove any merchandise that features the chief. help remove outdated and racist imagery from campus, reads a recent Facebook post by the University of Illinois student government. Exchange your former mascot clothing for brand new official Illinois merchandise at any of the locations that they list. While supplies last, golly, I wonder if Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign will run the same buyback deal. Anyway, while that's going on college campuses of an unserious nature, there is a serious issue about the incidence of sexual assault between professors and students. This piece by John Murawski, RealClearInvestigations.com, not the male rape culture on campus that the left focuses on, which is male students and female students. This is about administrative staff and faculty. And this was something called from a survey by a left-wing group, the Association of American Universities, that John Murawski unearthed. And it speaks to perhaps a systemic problem between those in positions of authority on college campuses and the students. The 33 institutions participating of the many respondents, respondents from 181,000 students last year, only 26% of the women at these 33 participating institutions responded. So the incident of allegations of sexual assault could be even higher than reported. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid author of the article, John Murawski, award-winning journalist. His piece at RealClearInvestigations.com, Buried, A Bad Faculty Report Card on College Sex Abuse. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Just to kind of detail what you found in this AAU study that has really not received any profile other than from you, and you know, put it in context of what's being discussed at the collegiate level.
Last fall, the American Association of Universities issued its campus sexual climate survey. They highlight the main points of the survey, and the main points of the survey essentially reiterate the frequently oft-cited and oft-disputed statistic that one out of four women can expect to be assaulted or raped when they're in college, during the 4 years they're in college. And so that's a very high number, and it suggests a crisis of huge proportions. And so inside the same report, but not featured, so it's not featured in the executive summary. I say it's buried because it's a little hard to find, and it takes experts to explain it, are statistics that indicate that these students also reported, female students, male students, and others, there's other categories, like LGBTQ categories for people who have different identities. But I just focused on women just because there's more women. They reported that some of these incidents, a small percentage of them, the perpetrators were faculty, instructors, professors, administrators, researchers, or other people who are associated or affiliated with the university. It appears as a this data appears as percentages, and they're very small percentages. It's like 0.3%, 0.5%, and you can't really tell. You can't tell how many incidents are really involved. But I had someone who's an expert in recent surveys work it out for me, and it looks like it comes out from these 33 universities. They had several hundred of such incidents, and we can't really tell what happened. We can't tell if the student is reporting something that was investigated by the Title IX office and basically thrown out for lack of evidence, or if the student reported that to the police and the professor was arrested, or if the instructor was just a graduate student. I don't want to say just, was a graduate student, and there were two graduate students dating, and when the student reported the incident, said, the question is, what's this person's affiliation with the university? So the person's affiliation with the university could be instructor, but they could be a TA, and they could be a grad student. So we don't really know any of the details, but there appears to be something going on. And we have corroborating evidence just in news coverage. If you do a Google search on sexual misconduct, faculty, professor, you will see lots of articles, because ever since Me Too in 2017, ever since Me Too blew up all over the world in 2017, students began coming forward with these stories about professors. And these stories are kind of similar to what you heard about the Catholic Church. There are these serial predatory professors, and some of them have been forced to resign. But previously, they were just moved around, and you know, they moved from college to college, or you know, behavior was downplayed, or it was very difficult, or these women just wouldn't come forward because no one would believe them.
Those are the stories. It's interesting because it reminds me a little bit of the Shake Shaft report from almost two decades ago that focused on the incidence of sexual abuse at the K through 12 level in public schools around the country. Carol Shake Shaft, an academic who did this study, and suggested that the incidence of sexual assault of students by adults in K through 12 was significantly higher than anything seen in the Catholic Church. And it sort of, you know, it sort of also was shunted aside. And then all of a sudden a decade, well, more than a decade plus later, but the Chicago Tribune, for example, recently looked at the last 5 years of sexual assault allegations in the Chicago public school and found more than 500 credible incidents, according to the city of Chicago's legal department. They determine credible accusations of sexual assault in the Chicago public schools. And it just it's interesting how certain individuals and certain institutions and certain institutions, as well as in certain institutions, don't seem to get the scrutiny that other people do. And these are people obviously with sensitive, important jobs in terms of educating children, whether you're talking K through 12 or higher ed.
Right. So, you know, with when you have these incidents between students, it's very easy to envision how you could, you know, how a student can cross the line. But it's also very easy to envision how you could have perfectly legitimate sexual encounters between students.
Right.
But with professors and students, faculty and students, administrators and, you know, researchers and grownups, essentially, it's harder to envision exactly what would be legitimate. In fact, some universities are banning any kind of dating, any kind of sexual contact between students and professors. Even if right now you're not supposed to be dating your own students, but you can date a colleague's student, right? But some universities are just moving to impose outright bans. So universities are beginning finally to move on this issue. And you could see that in the news coverage. So it's just very recent.
And the case with the university, obviously, these aren't statutory rape cases like it is at K through 12, but still all kinds of ethical problems arise with a culture where that's allowed.
Right. There are all sorts of issues, even if it's somebody else's. So, for example, I talk to some of these advocates, and they do make a pretty compelling case that and they have reports. There have been some reports done on this and some analysis. So that even if a professor is dating a student, and that is not the professor's student, it's just somebody else's student, and everybody can see that a professor is dating the student, that makes it awkward for any other student really to chat with that student about their professors, because it could just get back to the professor whom the student is dating,
yeah.
And it just creates a very awkward atmosphere. And so they want to create an outright ban. On the other hand, you know, these are adults, and there have been marriages between professors and students, very happy marriages that have lasted for decades. And so, you know, once you get into the business of banning and regulating human sexual conduct, it creates, you know, other kinds of issues. But it's a very tough situation.
John Murawski, award-winning journalist. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
It's a nice day for a white wedding. It's a nice day to start again.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. 44 this hour, we'll be talking to Nolan Finley, the editorial page out of the Detroit News, talking to him to preview tomorrow's Michigan primary between Biden and Bolshevik Bernie, Creepshow Joe and Bolshevik Bernie. But this is fun. Hillary Clinton back in the spotlight. Does she ever leave? I hope she doesn't, and I hope she never does, because she has such utility. Michael Goodwin, our friend from the New York Post, writing, Democrats' hunt for Trump slayer may lead to Hillary Clinton comeback. Never count her out. She's always angling and scheming and skullduggering her way to a shot at the throne, of course, a very Cersei-like. He suggests that Hillary Clinton's waiting in the wings, hoping for an invitation. Before you laugh, consider the T-O-O, weird twists and turns of Biden's campaign. The widespread belief that the former Veep is ready and able to go the distance strikes me as wishful thinking at best, writes Michael Goodwin. It is suspect because it is so sudden and reflects a complete reversal of the sentiment about him less than 2 weeks ago. Right, left for dead before South Carolina, now the heir of inevitability after Super Tuesday. Laud the likes of Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, in addition to, of course, Klobuchar and Buttigieg and Bloomberg, all falling in line. This is the man to unite the country after it was the man who was left for dead just 2 weeks ago. Goodwin's right about that. I don't know if he's right about the prospect of Hillary waiting in the wings if Biden falters, but perhaps, because where else do you go? It's not even obvious where you go for a running mate for Biden. Shortlist is believed to include Kamala Harris, Reparation H, Amy Klobuchar, who put herself on the ticket this weekend, or attempted to, as well as the two female senators from New Hampshire, Jeanine Shaheen and Maggie Hassan, and Stacey Abrams, the failed gubernatorial candidate from Georgia. Okay, that may start making Hillary Clinton look good, although, and she's already indicated, you know, she's willing to serve in whatever capacity. He writes, though, going back to Goodwin's piece, what I'm describing and what everybody's describing about Joe Biden leaves Clinton as the best backup plan. She's hardly my cup of tea, but for all her problems, including doubts about her physical stamina, she is a fundraising machine, has a true following, and could hit the ground running. And if you hadn't noticed, she's advertising her availability. No coincidence that Hillary, in quotation marks, that Hulu, four-part Hulu series, which we discussed on Friday's show, was released on Friday night with all kinds of teases about Bill Clinton's affair with Lewinsky and other such things that, you know, cast Hillary Clinton in the survivor market position again. Also this, Hillary Clinton on the Sunday talk shows, Fareed Zakaria. We've gone from the vast right-wing conspiracy 25 years ago to the vast right-wing echo chamber this go-around. Hillary Clinton complaining about that vast right-wing echo chamber, as well as about Facebook, which apparently is part of it. Who knew?
On Super Tuesday, on Facebook, the single most searched article, the single most searched news topic was Hillary Clinton's emails.
That's right. I saw that. Think about it. Well, I'll tell you what I make of it, is that Fox and the sort of right-wing echo chamber has mastered Facebook, aided and abetted, might I say, by Facebook. So I read that article, and what that said to me was, here at Super Tuesday, the Democrats are trying to decide who they want to nominate against Donald Trump. The coronavirus is spreading. We now have more and more reports from different places in the country. But led by Fox News and Breitbart and others, it's going to be about my emails, a totally, you know, bogus, finished, nonsense attack on me, because they know how not only to drive those stories under the radar screen where the mainstream press like yourself are covering, you know, what's happening now, but they know how to deliver those stories through the algorithms into the feeds of millions and millions of people. So I begrudgingly give them a lot of credit because they are shaping a narrative that is part of the messaging around Trump's reelection, around people who challenge Trump, changing the subject all of the time. You know, they're not interested or even worried about Trump saying that the coronavirus is a hoax.
Yeah, I mean, so, of course, Hillary Clinton projecting onto others who she is. Trump said coronavirus is a hoax? Never said that. Never said that. At a rally, he referred to the Democrats' latest hoax of trying to pin coronavirus on him. That's not saying the virus is a hoax, is it now? No. So disingenuous misdirection play. Why was she the number one search? Because Judicial Watch, which served as the shadow Department of Justice under the Obama administration, got a judge to order Hillary Clinton to be deposed in a case about her emails.
Political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Michigan primary tomorrow. it could be Bolshevik Bernie's last stand. If he doesn't win Michigan, I mean, he can carry on. He'll carry on for a while yet, but Joe Biden is going to extend the delegate lead, and the air of inevitability will be that much stronger around him. We have polling from Ogden and Fry, which is a Chicago-based robo-polling firm, that has Biden up 30 points on Sanders in Illinois. And remember, 4 years ago, Sanders came back to win Michigan, and he narrowly lost Illinois, 51-49, to Hillary. So it just feels different than it did 4 years ago when Bernie was surging and Hillary Clinton was sort of a bobber in the water. It actually feels almost the opposite right now. That's despite the fact that Joe Biden isn't exactly affording himself any better on the campaign trail in St. Louis, Missouri over the weekend. Joe Biden is become Irish, and he's rooting for Trump's reelection.
We cannot get reelected. We cannot win this reelection. Excuse me. We can only reelect Donald Trump.
You want to nominate a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat, a proud Democrat, an O'Biden-Bama Democrat.
An O'Biden-Bama Democrat. That's a new kind of Democrat. We got, you got your blue dogs, you got your yellow dogs. Now you have your O'Biden-Bama Democrats. Okay. Bernie Sanders, to his effort to try to turn around his flailing campaign, brought in Jesse Jackson Sr. to Grand Rapids.
I stand with Bernie Sanders today because he's still with me. I stand with him because he stands with you.
Was it me, or did Jesse Sr. seem a little sleepy? For more on this, in Michigan in particular, we're pleased to be joined by Nolan Finley, conservative editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Nolan, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Maybe Biden thought it was St. Patrick's Day.
That's exactly right. Everybody's Irish. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that could be. I mean, you got to keep coming up with innovative rationalizations to explain Biden's performance on the trail, don't you? I wonder how that is being received in Michigan. It seems to be ignored at this point, as Biden has moved ahead of Bernie after his Super Tuesday performance in Michigan.
Well, it's hard. Michigan's a hard place to tell looking at the primary. I would remind everybody, on this day 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton, every single poll had her up plus 20 or more. The Real Clear Politics average was Clinton by 21.4, and Bernie beat her on election day by about 1 or 2 points. It was a narrow victory, but he beat her and kept his campaign alive. Michigan does squirrely things in primaries. You know, we just heard from Jesse Jackson. Michigan gave its primary votes to Jesse Jackson at one time. It continuously baffles in the primary. And I wrote a piece yesterday. Don't count Bernie out.
Right.
I don't think this is over yet.
But in that same piece, you also wrote that some of the indicators that were present for his comeback 4 years ago are not present now.
Yeah, no, he whooped her in the outstate areas, outside of the metro area, badly last time. And this time they're tied. Older voters are going with Joe. Younger voters, of course, those under 30, 35 are still with Bernie, but there's no indication they'll vote. They haven't been voting. I think it'd be tougher this time for him to surprise. But my question is, you know, if tomorrow does put a spear in Bernie, and all Democrats have left is Joe Biden, and they wake up and look at Joe Biden as their candidate, that can't make them feel excited and enthused. This is not a candidate that's going to ignite great passion in their electorate.
So, Nolan, with the conventional wisdom about Biden being a question of stamina and mental acuity, his VP pick becomes so much more important than the customary presidential candidate. Amy Klobuchar seemed to indicate she was it when she slipped up and said she was joining the ticket. She said she meant to say terrific Biden team. Okay, she may be shortlisted, but it seems that he needs to find a younger, perceptibly capable, and probably female running mate. Is that your view?
Well, and one that doesn't scare people to death. I mean, some of the names that are being thrown around, no experience, far left, there for identity politics reasons, I don't think that's going to get him across the finish line. And I, you know, I don't know about his stamina. He does seem to be slipping mentally, but again, I'm not an expert in that. But regardless of that, he is simply not a guy who excites the electorate. And the more he tries to excite the electorate, the worse he sounds. So the Democrats are going into the election, including here in Michigan, counting on an anti-Trump vote. And, you know, history would indicate people don't vote against a candidate. They vote for a candidate. And I just don't see Biden doing much better than Clinton in exciting people to the polls.
Interesting. So you think that Trump, right, if, you know, all things being equal and there's a lot to happen between now and November, is in a position to hold serve in Michigan?
Yeah, no, I think he could. I think he could. I think now Biden will do better in the black communities than Clinton did. They wanted no part of her, Michigan's black voters. But I do think Trump will have an easier time than people are believing against Joe Biden.
You think that some of those
he's
people...
He's not that strong a candidate anymore.
And do you think that many of those voters who voted for Trump, particularly maybe first-time Republican voters who crossed over to vote for Trump, they're sticking with him in Michigan?
I have no evidence that they're leaving him. I mean, but, you know, there's still a lot of variables, and we're in the middle of one. You know, it's always about the economy. The economy's been chugging along, and I can't tell you the number of never-Trumpers and Democrats I talked to in recent weeks who have said, well, it'd be hard to vote against Trump with this economy. And that was particularly true when it looked like Bernie was going to be the nominee. But if this economy tanks because of the coronavirus, I think it would have been hard for any president to get reelected. Remember John McCain, and he was riding fairly high in 2008 when it was a national security election. When it became an economy election, he tanked.
Well, right. He also said the economy is not my bag and suspended his campaign, right, which did not inspire a lot of confidence. But your point is well taken, that it reshuffles the deck. He is Nolan Finley. He's the editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Nolan, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Take care. Why can't we just try?
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and this is perhaps the most disturbing news to come from the coronavirus spread that I've heard to date. You know, I'm trying to follow the mantra of keep calm and carry on, but it's difficult when Costco announced it is suspending free samples at Costco. Not since the run on coffee at Airplane has there been such a crisis.
Are you telling us absolutely everything?
Not exactly. We're also out of coffee.
And that's what it was like at Costco's around the country when news of that spread virally. I wanted to go to this piece in Washington Examiner from, a regular human being, a guy named Daryl Austin, small business owner and writer based in Utah. He writes that he can't wait for the coronavirus to get here. I mean, in other words, get to his family. Sort of interesting. He's so exasperated by the panicking, he'd rather just get on with it already. He writes, I wonder if this is you. I just learned last week something. There was used to be something called chickenpox parties. Now, I get chickenpox as a late grade school, maybe seventh or eighth grade. But I don't remember chickenpox parties, but apparently my co-host in Chicago, Amy Jacobson, she and her school did have chickenpox parties. And we heard from other callers to our show in Chicago that that was a thing. I had no idea, never heard of that. So coronavirus parties, I don't know, but Daryl Austin may be willing to host one based on this op-ed. Why my family isn't afraid of this virus, why we want to get it over with instead of prolonging the inevitable. Per the New York Times, several medical experts have said those who have been infected with the coronavirus will not become infected again, as their bodies will produce antibodies that provide immunity. One doctor in China saying, as long as the virus doesn't evolve, there is no chance of being infected again. Now, there is a case out of Japan, a Japanese tour guide, where the authorities suggested that tour guide was infected after being treated in the hospital and released, did get infected again, but it's disputed whether or not that person was actually cured when released. Nevertheless, it seems there's very few incidents of it so far, and as this medical professional says, right now, based on what we know, if the virus doesn't evolve, then the likelihood of getting infected again seems de minimis. He also adds, too, it doesn't seem to infect children who are otherwise healthy. The BBC reporting that of the more than 3,000 corona deaths so far, only 8 have occurred in people under 30, none at all in children age 10 or under. And we heard early in the show from Surgeon General Jerome Adams, the average age of a person who's died from coronavirus, 80. The average.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft. And this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show.
Coronavirus may never actually impact my family, he writes, but if it ever does, I hope it happens sooner rather than later.
The nation this week
of daily anticipation
with Margaret Brennan, and he painted a little bit more grim picture and talked about more dramatic steps than certainly
over with already.
Trump administration officials that were dispatched to go on the other Sunday talk show were offering. Gottlieb talking about
far
in this country doing
news,
something similar to what's happening in Italy
story
at present,
this
which
is
quarantining a quarter of the population and shutting down local economies, and suggesting that very same thing may need to be done here.
No state and no city wants to be the first to basically shut down their economy, but that's what's going to need to happen. States and cities are going to have to act in the interest of the national interest right now to prevent a broader epidemic.
Shut down their economy. You mean
close businesses, close large gatherings, close theaters, cancel events. I think we need to think about how do we provide assistance to the people of these cities who are going to be hit by hardship, as well as the localities themselves, to try to give them an incentive to do this. Right now, if there's no economic support to do this, you don't want to be the first to go. And I think you're seeing that. This exposes one of the challenges of our federal system, that we leave a lot of authority to state and local officials. And there's good reasons why. But in a situation like this, where you want them to act not just in their local interests, but the national interests, I think we need to think about both trying to coerce them, we can't force them, but also try to provide some incentives in terms of support. And we're going to end up with a very big federal bailout package here for stricken businesses, individuals, cities and states. We're better off doing it up front and giving assistance to get them to do the right things than do it on the back end after we've had a very big epidemic.
Now, Dr. Gottlieb makes the point that he's not opposed to federalism. There's good reasons to have decentralized power, but there are places for the federal government to intervene, and this is one, and to do so preemptively. Now, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things that's easier to say than to actually do in any sensible way. How do you offer a preemptive bailout package, essentially, when you don't even have a denominator on the number of people infected, when you can't really predict the progression of the virus, much less the lethality of it, and much less the need for things like hospitalization? So what could you do that $8.5 trillion that's already been authorized can't do? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Walter Williams. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University and syndicated columnist. Professor Williams, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it. What do you think about what Dr. Gottlieb had to say about the need to think for local economies to think about what's in the national interest and for the federal government to think about bailing out local economies?
I think that we're exaggerating the severity of the problem. And keep in mind, how many Americans have died as a result of the disease? Is it 10 or 15?
22 now, but yes, you're
22.
Yeah.
And it turns out that so far during this flu season from September up until just right about now, 18,000 Americans died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From flu. And so you have to put it in perspective. And then the people who are very adversely affected are people who have compromised respiratory systems and people who are elderly. Those are the people who are harmed most. And then I hear several doctors saying that a lot of people might have the coronavirus and they don't know it. They have a fever for a day or two, and then they stay home from work, and then in 3 days there it's all gone.
Well, right, and you know this is sort of an interesting case study, and when it comes to government and government officials, there's usually no reward for exercising any kind of restraint, waiting for more information to become available that would inform a sensible choice. Now, you want to be hyper-responsive to the extent that you have resources you can deploy in a sensible way that would improve a situation. But when you don't, the default position is still, well, let's just do something or give the appearance of doing something.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind with almost anything that is to underestimate, to severely underestimate the problems associated with the virus is an error, and to overestimate, to respond where we don't respond in a way that's out of proportion, that's just as bad, or could possibly be worse. And we could be sitting here, let's say September comes around, and we find out, maybe at the most 100 Americans died or whatever, and it was not as bad as we thought it would be. And here we've expended huge resources, closing down schools, closing down jobs, et cetera, and for nothing.
Right. And, I mean, you've had Dr. Jerome Adams, the Surgeon General. He was on with Jake Tapper over the weekend and said, look, here's what we know. We know that the average age of fatality is 80 years old. The average age of somebody who needs to seek medical treatment in response to being infected is 60 years old. So this is not to say it's not dangerous for people that are in younger demographics, but there's, with 100,000 cases plus worldwide, we're starting to get some data that give us at least some early indicators of who's most vulnerable to this.
I think he's absolutely right. And also, I think you have to keep in mind that once this thing starts, it becomes, at least in our country, it's become a political game. It's become a tool against the Trump administration. And then also, the people want a lot of money. They want $8.5 billion, and $8.5 billion will go a long way towards cronyism. That is to give out favors, to do this and do that in the name of advancing one's political career. I think that's a real danger. And then I think the World Health Organization and some other health organizations, they've said that the United States is the best prepared country in the world to handle this problem.
I wanted to switch gears and get your reaction to this piece as well, since over the years you've written so much about what's happening on college campuses. This an argument made at RealClearPolitics.com by a New York writer named Anthony DeMauro, who suggests that the narrative of discrimination against conservatives in higher education is overblown. He writes that much like how we often hear there aren't enough women in STEM, the argument that American universities discriminate against conservative professors is flawed if disparity statistics are your only metric. Universities cannot be said to be discriminating against conservative professors based on these stats because disparity alone does not indicate discrimination. He suggests, personal choices play a role in the professional landscape and thus its ideological disparity. So while there is clearly a disparity in the number of people who identify as conservative versus liberal in the professorate as well as in the student body, that's not necessarily indicative of conservative discrimination on campus.
I wrote a column a few weeks ago, and I was pointing out to the leftist bias at the campus, and I'm making actual quotations from professors. For example, a Rutgers University professor said, quote, "Watching the Iowa caucus is a sickening display of overrepresentation of whiteness." Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who's a professor at Berkeley, he says, think about this. Iowa was 90% white. Iowa is now the only state with a voting lifetime voting ban for convicted prisoners. And black people make up 4% of Iowa's population. And then there's a study, recent study, and these are all available at my website, walterewilliams.com, about the bias. And a recent study shows that that Democrat professors outnumber their Republican counterparts most in the humanities and the social sciences. That is, it's in anthropology, the ratio of Democrat registered professors to Republican is 42-1. In sociology, 27-1. In English, 27-1. And so you find these huge disparities. You find all this stuff about diversity and multiculturalism on college campuses that's teaching our students the wrong ideas. And that's, it's not being promoted by Republican professors. It's being promoted by Democrat and leftist professors.
Well, and it seems to me, right, the obvious question back to the author and those who argue similarly is, oh, okay, so let me ask you a question. Do you think that the instruction on campus and the climate on campus would be any different if it was 14, 15, 20, 27, 30 to 1 in the humanities, conservative to liberal, in the administration, 10, 15, 20 to 1, conservative, liberal? Do you think that would change anything on campus? And of course, the answer is yes. And they have to admit it was they'd have to admit it was yes. And so obviously, it's very different on campus with that unbelievable one-sidedness. And we just had this story out last week about Harvard, where, you know, the majority of people, or the plurality of Harvard professors, are Bernie Sanders supporters, and 1% are Trump supporters. Well, flip that script. Do you think the climate would be any different at Harvard if the plurality were Trump supporters and only 1% were Bernie supporters?
Well, of course it would. And that political bias will find its way into their classes, particularly in the social sciences. Maybe it's pretty difficult to get it into a math or an engineering class, but their political biases show up in English. You know, that, like, a lot of colleges will not have students, don't assign students the works of Shakespeare and other great writers, because they're old dead white men. They put on the more modern writers, and so students go through college and won't come into the writings of the great classics of our time.
He is Walter Williams, professor of economics at George Mason University, syndicated columnist. Get all of his writings at walterewilliams.com. Professor Williams, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
And thank you. Bye.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. In 2016, it was Wall Street versus Main Street. That was one way to think about it. And in Bolshevik Bernie parlance, as you see, as Marxists do, see everything through a class prism. It's the lower and middle classes against the oligarchs, the billionaires, the plutocrats, the upper classes. What about if there's a bit of a struggle within the middle, or the upper middle? And again, I don't like to speak in the lexicon of class, because America is an exceedingly mobile society, and we should always jealously guard that. But what if there is a fight among the middle that is not properly contemplated by the political class, at least in terms of the way they address the electorate? Our friend Joel Kotkin over at Quillette, he writes for a number of outlets, this one in Quillette.com, writes of the two middle classes, an important piece that frames how we may analyze the 2020 election. Joel Kotkin is an internationally recognized authority on global economic, political, and social trends. He's a presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University and author of The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us. Joel, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So the yeomanry versus the clerisy. It sounds positively Game of Thrones. Explain the distinction between the two.
Well, it is medieval, so maybe there's some resonance there as well. I mean, basically, people talk about the middle class as being sort of one group. But, you know, and the people that I've, you know, let's go down through history, you read people, you know, Marx, Weber, de Tocqueville, they always understood, or even Edmund Burke, you know, that there were different parts of the middle class, that it wasn't just one group of people. And today we really have two different middle classes. And, you know, we see it very clearly. I live in California, which is always sort of the, you know, petri dish on steroids. But we see that here in California. There are areas that are very middle class and even upper middle class, let's say, here in where I live in Orange County, around Irvine, they vote very liberal. They'll elect a Elizabeth Warren clone as a congressperson. There are other places that are middle class where people work in construction. They own small businesses. They're artisans. These people tend to be much more conservative, and it really is about your relationship to the state. If you are in a profession where government intervention is actually good for business, you're going to tend to favor government intervention, and you'll justify it as people always justify whatever they think. On the other hand, if you're, let's say, running a little business on Main Street and you are concerned that your profits are being taxed, you're going to have to use, you know, certain pronouns or whatever sort of insanity comes out of Sacramento, you feel oppressed by it. So it's a real difference. And you know, in the long run, of course, the failure of the private sector, the free market part of the economy, will eventually affect the people at the Clarcy. But, you know, fundamentally, the average, you know, University of California administrator who's going to retire with a $200,000 a year pension fundamentally doesn't care if the government gets bigger. It doesn't it doesn't hurt them at all as long as they get their pension checks. The guy who's got the woman who's got the little restaurant on Main Street, that person is much more vulnerable. So what we're seeing is, for instance, President Trump, for all his, you know, sort of negative characteristics, is very popular among this first group, the yeomanry, the small business owner. They feel that he will sort of keep the government off his neck somewhat, off their neck somewhat. On the other hand, Trump is extraordinarily unpopular in those areas that are dominated by very highly educated professionals, most of whom are not operating in the market system and are not as exposed to regulation as the average small business.
And so what happens, I mean, you know, some providing some historical context here, Michael Lind, who writes a lot about the sort of divide, and he focuses on sort of the college educated versus the not college educated. But this is similar. Basically, you have a small cadre of folks in the clerisy, as you describe it, and a much larger group in the yeomanry and below, frankly. And, you know, what happens when a revolt like occurred in 2016 is repressed, if that were to occur, when people believe that things are getting better and could get better still, and that's put down by sort of the small group of people who occupy those positions of civic authority in the clerisy? It seems to me that's a real tinderbox for a free society.
I agree entirely. I mean, I think that what we're going to be seeing in this country, I fear the 2020 election on both sides. I can see for sure if Trump is reelected that, you know, the university students and, you know, and the clerisy will go completely insane. There'll be demonstrations everywhere. Look, there were demonstrations last time when Trump was elected. On the other hand, you may have a different kind of response among the people who are, you know, now, let's say, the small business owner who says, oh, my God, now Joe Biden's going to come in and he's going to ban this and he's going to add this. Because, you know, the bottom line is that I think people have a good reason to fear that Biden will just be pushed by his, you know, more left of center, more interventionist people, and that there will be a, you know, one of the problems we have in this country, frankly, is that we now seem to have a, you know, we really elect dictators. You know, Bush became somewhat of a dictator. Certainly Obama tried to act like a dictator, and Trump tries to act as a dictator, and whoever wins in 2020 will try to act like a dictator. And that means that the stakes for the individual parts of the middle class are much greater. If you're operating in a town in Texas and the government's going to ban fracking, or you're in a town that builds airplanes and all of a sudden you're being told, oh no, we're just going to do high speed rail. I mean, any of those kinds of things could have catastrophic effects on large parts of the yeomanry, the people who sell to the people who make planes, the people who work building planes. All these kinds of things are going to have severe effects. And I think that this division between these two parts of the middle class will be, I think, exacerbated no matter who wins.
When we come back with Joel Kotkin, I want to talk about the rule of law. Andy McCarthy, I thought, had an interesting observation in commenting on the Chuck Schumer flack from last week that I think folds into what you're describing in your piece. More with Joel Kotkin, who's Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University and author of The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us, right after this.
Listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
We're back with Joel Kotkin. He is an internationally recognized authority on global economic, political, and social trends, Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University, author of The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us. And Joel, picking up on our discussion about the bifurcated middle class, there was this incident last week with Chuck Schumer targeting Kavanaugh, Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch by name and suggesting, you know, they'll have hell to pay. We know where you live if you go the wrong way on this Louisiana abortion law. And Andy McCarthy writing in National Review as to the question of should Chuck Schumer be censured for the comments that he made targeting those two justices and essentially, arguably, trying to intimidate them politically. McCarthy writes, in a rule of law society, that should rate censure. Case closed. Except it's not closed because we're not a rule of law society. We just pretend to be. In a rule of law society, a mob would not gather on the steps of the courthouse in the first place. And then he goes on to explain why the mob is there, because the Supreme Court took over, arguably, the legislative function with respect to Roe v. Wade. But without getting into Roe v. Wade, just for Andy McCarthy, a former federal prosecutor, to argue that we are no longer in a rule of law society, that's the jarring statement to me. And I think that's what a lot of people feel on both sides, to some extent what you were describing before about the expansion of presidential power, and to a large extent what's happened over the last 3 years, too, where we seem to see different laws apply differently to different people based on political clout. And that, to me, seems to be as much of a danger and a delegitimizing factor as anything happening economically.
Well, I think that's definitely the case. And I think, again, it's the yeomanry, which is, you know, generally not well organized, doesn't really know how to, if you will, play the game, that is most vulnerable to that kind of policy. You know, law, in many ways, our system of law was really based in large part coming out of England, of, you know, protecting property rights. You know, there are should be some limitations to that, but the basic idea is if I own this little business or I own this piece of property, I have certain rights within that context. The scary thing, and a very old liberal friend of mine, and I don't consider myself a conservative at all, but an old liberal friend of mine, when I was in New York the other week, basically said that what scares him is not so much that it's authoritarian as it's totalitarian. That, in other words, we are moving towards a situation where people in the legal profession actually begin to endorse ideas of you know, that this is that certain kinds of things are not permissible. That you can't say this and you can't say that. Look, anybody today who teaches or lectures or gets in front of an audience now lives in some sort of fear that if I say the wrong thing, I'm going to get, they're going to go after me and I'm going to lose my funding. So we're already seeing that not just, you know, property is not protected, but intellectual property is not protected. And I think the great fear that people have, I think, is that if you have, let's say in this year, you know, Joe Biden wins, he's going to be a pretty weak person himself, but he may be surrounded by people who want to accelerate this kind of, you know, thought control. This could really become a problem, because, you know, essentially whether it's in literature or history or law, sort of a postmodernist mentality has now taken over, in which what we thought of as the rules of the game really no longer apply. It's the rules as the clerisy defines them,
and they're ever changing.
Is very scary.
And they're ever changing, right? So there's no stability or predictability about it.
Let's say on the green movement, 5 years ago, President Obama and many others said, well, natural gas is obviously the way to reduce emissions without, you know, overwhelmingly disrupting the economy and keeping prices, having prices be too high. Now it's not enough. Now you can't do natural gas. Now we have cities in California banning natural gas. I mean, so, you know, so what happens is it keeps going further and further. You know, you go from, women's rights to gay rights now to policies being devised for groups, transgender groups, who are a tiny percentage of the population, but loom as enormous percentages of the population in the media and in the arts. So it just has this tendency to continue to escalate, and it has now infected, and I think this would be the thing that I would focus on if I was making this argument, is in law schools, how people are taught about the law. They're not really taught about, well, there are legal principles and you need to enforce them. They're increasingly saying the legal system exists to create what one might define as social justice. And that's the beginning of the end. That's exactly what happened in Russia. It's what happened in Nazi Germany. It's what happened under Mussolini. And unfortunately, we're headed in that direction. And, you know, do I necessarily trust those people who define what justice is if it's basically subjective and not something that is backed up by law or tradition?
He is Joel Kotkin, presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University, author of The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us. Check out his piece we were discussing at Quillette.com, The Two Middle Classes, which I'll tweet out at the end of our show. Joel Kotkin, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Installment of Campus Beat. We go to University of Chicago. University of Chicago, given a lot of credit for its statement a few years back, now referred to as the Chicago Statement, in opposition to trigger warnings and safe spaces on campus. But is University of Chicago really living up to the ideals that were expressed in a missive to the class of 2020 back in 2016? By John Ellison, the Dean of Students at the University of Chicago. Our commitment to academic freedom means we do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial. And we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own. And this drew some backlash among the professor at University of Chicago, but it was hailed as, oh, yes, University of Chicago standing against the leftist orthodoxy, the intolerant, totalitarian leftist orthodoxy in so many campuses. Robert Zimmer, the president of the university, followed up that missive from Ellison with an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal reiterating the same points, writing, universities cannot be viewed as a sanctuary for comfort, but rather as a crucible for confronting ideas and thereby learning to make informed judgments in complex environments. Having one's assumptions challenged and experiencing the discomfort that sometimes accompanies this process are intrinsic parts of an excellent education. Only then will students develop the skills necessary to build their own futures and contribute to society. Sounds great. Are they practicing what they preached? Answer, not so much. Not so much. Avita Duffy is a sophomore at U of C. She's also the daughter of retiring Congressman Sean Duffy from Wisconsin. Last week, as she writes in an op-ed in Chicago Maroon, the campus paper, last week I was asked by the University of Chicago's Institute for Politics, that has been renamed by me for purposes of my show as the Institute for Political Skullduggery. That is the one in which David Axelrod has been installed to enjoy a sinecure in his dotage. Yeah. Last week, I was asked by the University of Chicago's Institute for Politics to participate in a digital initiative called I Vote Because, fill in the blank, where students pose with a small whiteboard, a la Karl Rove,
stating their personal reasons for voting. Some examples included, I vote because, fill in the blank, Medicare for all. I vote because universal health care shouldn't be considered a radical idea. I vote because children shouldn't be kept in cages. By the way, you're starting to get a feel for the ideological disposition of the student body at USC. Okay. What Avita Duffy wrote, the blank, how she filled in her blank. I wrote, I vote because the coronavirus won't destroy America, but socialism will. I vote because the coronavirus won't destroy America, but socialism will. Is that outrageously offensive to you? Should it be to anybody? I mean, at worst, is it not the jumping off point for a conversation? No, no, no. Duffy goes on to write, as a conservative Hispanic woman, I'm accustomed to being in the minority opinion, especially on a liberal college campus. I'm a proponent of free speech, and I hope my whiteboard message might encourage a lively and robust debate on economics. That's not what happened. Fellow students attacked my character, my intellect, my family, my appearance, and even threatened me with physical violence using foul and offensive language. I was called a racist and a xenophobe. I mean, it's just, it's our discussion with Joel Kotkin. You just say racist or xenophobe, regardless of the comment to which you're responding. Talking about socialism, it makes you racist. Socialism will destroy America. That's racist? Xenophobic? Okay. She goes on. Some compare me to animals. Others declared that they would personally stop me from voting. Many defended the personal attack, saying I deserve to be bullied and I don't belong at the University of Chicago on account of my beliefs. I was told by many that I was the most hated person on campus. I've been there before. That was my experience at Northwestern. It was frightening. It was also hurtful, since some of the attacks came from people I considered are friends. Well, now as you know better. As of writing this opinion, writes Ms. Duffy, the administration, you know, Robert Zimmer and company that talks so much about free marketplace of ideas and ideas being challenged, the crucible for confronting ideas, not a sanctuary for comfort, Zimmer's words. Where are they now? The administration and the Institute for Politics have not come to my defense, writes Duffy, nor have they condemned the intolerance and violence students have directed toward me. She goes on to suggest that perhaps the reaction would be different if there was that kind of vitriol that was being directed at a member of the LGBTQ community or Muslim student on campus. But as a conservative, regardless of the fact she's female and a minority, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. I knew it was a liberal place, but I honestly believed our university president, Robert Zimmer, when he said our school was committed to the Chicago principles, which protect free speech and encourage open debate. Right now, that claim feels like false advertising. You know why it does? Because it is, Evita. And I'm sorry she had to learn the hard way, but it's easy to write op-eds and wave a flag. It's a lot more difficult to advance the flag when called to do so in the face of opposition, isn't it? Particularly for the namby-pamby set that is in charge of most of America's universities, whether on the administrative side or the professorate. Avita Duffy, though, is clearly a fighter, resilient. She is pushing back, not only with this op-ed, but also her disposition as actually a representative of what Robert Zimmer and John Ellison wrote back in 2016 that they no longer want to defend in 2020, it would appear. Writes Ms. Duffy, my hope is this sad episode leads to serious reflection on the value of civility when we do debate and disagree. I hope it will also draw attention to the importance of intellectual and political diversity on campus and in classrooms. The University of Chicago needs to live up to its own standards and set an example of civility, diversity, and tolerance during these hyperpartisan times. Well, Avita Duffy is an enlightened young woman. Unfortunately, enlightened is not a description you can use with the adults in charge of University of Chicago, at least to the extent that they allow this episode to go unchallenged, unremarked upon. This is the Dan Prof Show.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. I'm all for innovative initiatives to improve campus safety, but I'm completely nonplussed by what Florida Atlantic University is doing, the student government, and the local bars and restaurants. Florida Atlantic University is working to provide safe haven for women, including at bars and restaurants, through the quote-unquote owl shot. Florida Atlantic mascot, the owls. So there you go, the owl shot. More than 10 bars and restaurants have partnered with the university's student government to hang posters in the ladies' rooms. And by the way, I hope those ladies' rooms are gender neutral, of course, so-called ladies' rooms. Posters in the bathrooms that provide instruction on how women can alert bartenders if they're in danger or feel uncomfortable. First, you order a drink called the owl shot. Then, depending on what's happening, you say one of three coded phrases displayed on the posters. Based on the code, here's how the bartenders will respond. All right. I got a guy harassing me, playing this out, trying to make sense of it. I got a guy harassing me, won't leave me alone, whatever. So I go to the bartender, I order an owl shot. If I order the owl shot neat, the bar staff will escort me to my car if I'm a girl in distress. If I order the owl shot on the rocks, the bar staff will call a ride. If I order the owl shot with lime, the bar staff will call police. The government relations director at FAU said, everyone's on board. Bar owners love it. The administration thinks it's a great idea. There's really been no negative response to it all. The initiative outlines the importance of for students to continue feeling at home even when they're out engaging with the local community. I love these phrases. You mean they're out at a bar or restaurant, engaging with the local community. Is that what you're doing when you go out for a drink or to eat? Okay. That's the student body president and vice president in a release with their important words. Students hope to eventually see their posters in every bar and restaurant in the area. This is the, you know, Boca Raton, Fort Lauderdale area. I don't understand why there's no follow-up question. If you're a woman in a public place like a bar or restaurant and someone is harassing you or worse, why do you have to order drinks and then speak in code to a bartender? Why wouldn't you just say to the bartender or bouncer or wait staff or whoever, hey, this guy's bothering me. Can you, you know, tell him to back off? In addition to most women, I think would have the wherewithal to tell him to back off themselves, particularly in a public place, bars or restaurants. The whole cloak and dagger aspect of this just baffles me. Am I being insensitive? I don't get it. Here's something they should offer in terms of instructions, particularly in the state of Florida, in the women's room, is where to go to get your concealed carry training and permit. So you're ready to handle yourself and you don't need to order an owl shot with lime in case you need to defend yourself from a would-be aggressor. But, I mean, hopefully it would never get that. Same thing in a public space. Why would it ever get to that level where you wouldn't just say to somebody, this guy's bothering me, or back off, or can you order me a ride? Why code? It's just so silly to me. But that's life on college campuses these days. Thank you for joining us for another edition of the Dan Prof Show. Please do so again tomorrow night.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Prof Show.
You are fake news.